Chapter 14. "Can we do it?" Perkins asked, trying to decide where to float in the cramped confines of the auxiliary control center. "Can we jump?" "Sure," Derek was quick to answer. "Problem is, we have no idea how to program a jump." "Colonel, I mean no idea. None of the training materials available to us even mention the subject."
"Well, there's no handy-dandy jump-back feature, like callback on a phone?" Perkins joked, though hoping that might be true.
"Even if there was, ma'am, I think the jump we did under the damping effect was so sloppy, the system wouldn't know where to go back to. We need to get some smart cadets up here to help us program the jump computer."
"Okay, but the drive can do that jump? Garner tells me there is plenty of power left in the capacitors."
"There should be more than enough, ma'am," Irene agreed. "We jumped out of a partial damping field. That takes a lot of extra power. Jumping back should use a lot less juice. Unless the drive coils got degraded from our jump, I'll have to ask the engineering team about that."
"Do it," Perkins ordered.
"I'll find some cadets who have at least a basic knowledge of jump physics," she added hopefully. Faster-than-light travel was critical to the Ruhar fleet and the whole war effort. Jump theory and navigation had to be an important topic at their training schools. Jump theory and navigation was an important topic at Ruhar training schools. Unfortunately, no cadet aboard the route to Stella had enough experience to actually program a live jump. Even the senior cadets had mostly learned jump physics and theory, not practical application. Fortunately, there was one person aboard the ship who had actual hands-on training in jump navigation, though even she had only worked with a simulator. Serkotra Tutula volunteered when she heard Perkins needed someone to assist.
"Thank you, but no, you don't understand." Irene let exasperation get the better of her.
"We don't need you to assist. We need you to do it. All of it. The two of us have absolutely no idea how any of this stuff," she waved her hands at the confusing jump controls on the display, "works. No idea."
"That is unfortunate."
Tutula frowned in a very human-like expression that was much better than a smile from her species.
"I will require qualified senior cadets to assist me with the calculations. The math is complicated, and verifying the calculations is a rigorous process."
"Thank you. If you need anything from us, let us know, but..." Irene scowled. She hated feeling useless and helpless to control her fate.
"Otherwise, we'll stay out of your way. As we are under a time constraint, it would be best if you were not involved. I might have time to explain the process later, but..."
"Yeah, we get it." Derek rubbed a hand along Irene's arm to soothe her bruised ego.
"Until we learn the basic theory, watching the process won't do us any good."
"Tutula, are the cadets going to be okay with a Verdcris programming one of their starships to jump?"
"No doubt some of them will not be pleased."
Tutula's expression was unreadably blank.
"Those who refuse to participate will be noted, and I expect Fleet Command to reprimand them appropriately. If not, I will."
Bift came back to confer with Jin Garner, this time without being escorted by Sergeant Jates, who was busy motivating a team of cadets working to patch a leaky fuel tank. Jin listened to Bift's whispered words, then,
"You are suggesting I sabotage our jump drive?"
Jin asked, incredulous.
"Shh!"
Bift's head snapped around, but no one had heard her words in the noisy compartment.
"No, only the drive control circuit,"
Bift explained, getting his natural cockiness back.
"We have to stop the alien from jumping us back to the battle space. It's insanity. It is suicide."
He reached for her shoulder for emphasis, but she pushed herself away.
"It might be risky," Jin admitted.
She was not entirely sure the jump drive coils would not explode when energized.
"What do you suggest we do?" "We stay here and wait for rescue. Without using power for jumps and propulsion, the reactor can..."
"The reactor won't last, I told you that."
"It is amazing you got it restarted at all."
Bift flashed a grin that used to be considered charming, but now he feared most cadets saw through his attempt to flatter and manipulate them. Jin only glared at him and folded her arms, so he hurried to continue.
Yes. While the reactor is working, we use it to charge up every power cell we have, so when the reactor has to be shut down, we can stretch out life support."
"Stretch it out how long? And when that runs out, we get into dropships and then we survive in spacesuits?"
"You weren't listening."
Her tone implied that was a common problem with Bift, Kolsun.
The fleet has no idea where we are. No idea. They don't even know we are missing yet.
Then waiting in one place is as good as any other. And we should stay right here rather than risking a jump.
Wrong. Jin brushed her bangs out of her eyes. The battle space was flooded with high-energy particles. If any place in the area will attract the attention of ships searching for us, it is there, not here.
Biff kicked himself for not thinking of that fact, and he was stubborn enough not to admit when he was wrong.
You know what else was in the battle space? A Bosphorak warship. It is too risky for us to jump back in there. Jin, all you need to do is...
No. No, I won't do it. And you are not doing it either. You leave my drive circuits alone.
Anger flared in her eyes.
You will obey this alien even though you know her plan is insane?
I am obeying because it is my duty and because I agree with her. We can't stay here while our reactor shuts down, then life support fails. There is nowhere within this ship's jump radius that will allow us to survive. Our best chance is if one of our ships is still in the area of the battle.
Now you are indulging yourself in wishful thinking.
Biff turned away in disgust. How could he have once wanted such a weak woman?
I wish to live, and you have not offered a better option. Now get out of my control center.
She waved him away.
I have work to do.
Irene held up a hand to get Perkins' attention. All stations report ready for jump, Colonel.
As ready as we're going to be, you mean?
Yes, ma'am. There isn't anything more we can check that hasn't been checked at least 3 times already. The unknowns are going to remain that way until we load power into the jump coils.
That would have to be good enough, whether Perkins liked it or not. For the record, she did not like it.
Remind me, how long after we jump until the sensors are able to give us useful data?
7 seconds for full reset, maybe 18 seconds to restore full capability, ma'am.
Irene cautioned the ship's current commander.
Problem is, the toaster's sensor suite got beat up pretty badly in the fight. We lost an entire array on the port side, and there are big gaps in the dorsal arrays.
Anything that would prevent the sensors from picking up a return echo from a Yankee search?
No. Those active pulses are so powerful I could detect a ship with my suit sensors if I were standing outside.
That won't be necessary, Strebitch.
The cadets had been appalled when they heard Perkins' plan to scan the battle space with active sensor pulses immediately after jumping in, because fleet doctrine was that stealth was life, and no one compromised stealth, especially not in a potential combat situation. Perkins' reasoning was the intense gamma-ray burst of their inbound jump would already illuminate their position to any ship in the area, and the toaster's stealth field was, well, basically toast at that point. If a stealthed Bosphorak ship was lingering around the battle space, Perkins would rather detect the enemy presence with a sensor echo than with maser bolts cutting into the route to Stella.
We will be ready to jump the hell out of there if we detect unfriendlies?
Yes, Derek called up the jump option list on his console. Short jump, then long. The quicker we have to initiate a jump, the less accurate it will be, he warned. Short-long was Ruhar Fleet's standard procedure for an escape jump. Conduct a short jump to get clear of the immediate battle space, and drop off quantum resonators just before the jump to confuse enemy sensors about where the ship had jumped to. Then conduct a longer jump with the hope that by the time the enemy determined where the far end of the short jump was, the escaping ship would be long gone. Derek agreed with the thinking behind the procedure, except the route to Stella was not equipped with quantum resonators, and they would need to pause for an estimated 40 minutes after the short jump to calculate their long jump. If a Bosphorak ship were waiting for them, Derek thought the toaster was as good as dead already.
Then there's no point waiting. Sound the alarm for jump prep and start feeding power into the coils.
Perkins closed her eyes briefly and said a silent prayer.
Please, God, don't let me screw this up. People are depending on me.
The route to Stella jumped with fair accuracy, considering that the jump had been programmed partly by a group of third-year cadets. According to the navigation system, they missed the target point by only 14,000 miles, in space warfare that was practically on top of their target. Perkins took that as a very good omen.
Anything? Perkins asked, with one eye on the clock and one on the sensor display.
10 seconds had gone by, and the display was still blank.
Then the display lit up. All over. Multiple contacts, Derek shouted, louder than needed. Wait, wait, he added to Irene, who had a finger poised on a button to jump them away. All contacts are solid, Colonel. We're not picking up a return with a fuzzy silhouette like we would if there were a stealth ship out there. There are a lot of contacts, though, he whistled. Looks like a big debris field.
Strebitch, keep your finger on that button, Perkins ordered. But don't activate a jump without my order. We've got a limited number of jumps before this bucket fails us.
As the sensor data became more clear, Perkins became less tense and more fearful. Unless a Bosphorak ship had a super effective stealth field or was so far away they hadn't received a sensor return yet, the battle space appeared to be empty of threats. It was also empty of potential rescuers.
Nothing? They're all gone?
Perkins leaned over Irene's chair, her eyes flicking from one part of the display to another. The area was cluttered with drifting debris, so much that the route to Stella twice had been forced to maneuver away to avoid colliding with spinning pieces of dangerous junk. Active sensors had thoroughly scanned the area out to 500,000 miles, and there was not a single intact ship anywhere near them. In most cases, the software's ship identification system had difficulty determining what type of ship most of the debris came from because the parts were so small and torn apart.
It looks that way, ma'am, Derek concluded. I'm sorry.
We're all sorry, Bonsu. Could a ship have gotten away?
It's possible,
Derek replied without a trace of hope in his voice. The system can only account for 63% of the mass that should be around us. But some of the ships, like that City of Sandep, blew up hard. There wouldn't be enough left of those ships to track the mass because a lot of the mass got converted to energy.
Any sign of the Delmian?
The forward section is gone. This is most of it, Derek indicated a loose cloud on the display.
But the aft section?
That's interesting. Looks like it's mostly together.
He enhanced the image to show a short section of the Star Carrier spine with a single empty docking platform attached to the aft engineering section.
Yeah. They took some hits there also.
As Derek continued to zoom in on the broken Star Carrier, they could see a reactor that had its plasma vented through a burn-through hole in the exterior shielding. The entire area around that reactor was scorched and melted.
That doesn't look good, Derek muttered.
Shit.
Perkins shook her head. She might have gotten all their hopes up for nothing. The route to Stella still could not jump far enough to get anywhere useful, and their single functional reactor was steadily failing. All they might have accomplished was slowly dying in that lonely part of interstellar space, rather than their previous position in lonely interstellar space.
Secure from active search, she ordered. It's too dangerous to send dropships out there, with all the debris drifting around.
The real problem was chunks of debris crashing into each other, creating more debris and sending pieces careening in all directions.
Launch a recon drone. I want a full scan of what's left of the Star Carrier. If you see another piece of debris out there large enough to investigate, send another drone. We can't afford to miss anything.
They didn't miss anything because there wasn't anything to be missed. Other than the aft section of the Delmian, the largest piece of debris was the size of a dropship. The Bosphorak battlecruiser had been brutally thorough in its destruction of the Ruhar ships, so much so that Perkins wondered whether the Bosphorak captain had a personal grudge against those Ruhar. Space combat rarely left significant parts of wounded ships intact. The kinetic energy of railguns and the explosive power of ship-killer missile warheads could quickly tear unprotected ships apart, while a single hit to a reactor or jump-drive capacitors could cause a ship to destroy itself. Still, Perkins had hoped to find something useful in the debris cloud, and she was straining to keep the necessary confidence in front of her reluctant crew. The second recon drone had flown around to examine several remnants of Ruhar ships and found nothing useful, so Perkins had recalled that drone after it unfortunately displayed images demonstrating that some of the debris drifting around were shattered Ruhar bodies. She did not need the cadets seeing frozen, charred, and bloated bodies of their people. Giving up on hoping to find a miracle in the smashed remains of the Ruhar battle group, she concentrated on what remained of the Star Carrier, knowing that section of the ship was extremely unlikely to contain a living Giraptha.
She gave her cadet crew plenty of time to examine the stricken star carrier, assigning two additional drones to the search, and not asking Jin for her opinion until 6 hours had passed.
"What do you think?" Perkins asked as she handed a squeeze bulb of hot claw to the senior cadet. "Is anything there salvageable? Useful to us?"
"No." Jin needed the claw to keep herself awake. "Their normal space propulsion system is scrap. A third of it is simply sheared away. Whatever hit there, it tore the power couplings loose. That ship isn't going to move on its own again."
"I saw that. What about the reactors? One of them looked fairly intact."
"There is one reactor that vented its plasma and shut down properly. Please, before you ask, no. We can't get anything useful from that star carrier's reactor. To restart our own reactor, I was able to rely on instructions that walked us through every step in great detail. And as you remember, we still had to abort the restart sequence 3 times because something went wrong that the procedures didn't anticipate. With a Gerapha reactor, we would be starting from absolute zero."
"Cadet, I have every confidence. You shouldn't. It is impossible."
"Wait." Jin held up a hand. "Please, Colonel. That reactor vented its plasma, but it is damaged. There are cracks in the exterior sheathing, and the containment magnets inside have become detached from their mounts. We can't fix it. I do not think even the Gerapha could repair that reactor without a shipyard capable of heavy-duty work.
It is impossible."
"Impossible."
She looked at Perkins from one eye to another, seeking understanding as if that particular word could not translate properly.
"Impossible, I understand. Cadet, you've done a remarkable job. I can't ask for more.
I accept there is no potential for using a Gerapha reactor to power our life support systems."
"Thank you, Colonel Perkins."
Jin shuddered slightly with relief and fatigue.
"No reactor, then.
What about
contact?"
Derek called excitedly over Perkins' Z-phone.
"We got something out there, ma'am. Looks like a Gerapha escape pod."
"Escape pod?"
Emily found her pilot's excitement to be infectious.
"Just one? Are there survivors aboard?"
"Just the one,"
Derek reported slowly as he reviewed the data on his console, hoping for better news.
"One intact. We found others that are damaged. This is the first one generating power. It began pinging a distress call a few seconds ago. Maybe it needed to get a certain distance from the battle space before it activated, or maybe it has a timer."
"Or maybe it picked up our signals," Perkins suggested.
"Survivors? All we're getting is a location ping, Colonel. We're too far away to see inside with our sensors. It could be empty, but it is pinging. And I don't know if a Gerapha pod would do that unless it was occupied. I couldn't find anything in the ship's database about operating procedures for Gerapha gear."
"Ah, damn it. Please tell me the debris field is relatively clear between us and that pod."
"Not a chance, ma'am."
"Damn it.
All right, send a drone."
The drone reported one living Gerapha was inside the escape pod, though it was in a state of semi-hibernation caused by the pod's mechanisms.
"I don't suppose the Beatles equipped their pods with the capability to rendezvous with a rescue vessel?"
Perkins asked hopefully.
"No, ma'am."
Irene turned to look up at their captain.
"I've worked with the cadet to research everything the ship's database knows about those pods, and they have a very limited ability to maneuver. Basically, they can move to avoid collisions, but that pod out there has used up all its fuel, so it didn't crash into the debris cloud. The casing has dents and scratches from impacts already. I hope it isn't damaged. We need to go out there and bring it to us."
"How did I know you were going to say that?"
Perkins crossed her arms as she floated behind the pilot couches.
"I suppose you are first in line to volunteer?"
"Well, Colonel,"
Irene winked at Derek. They had tossed a coin and Derek lost.
"If you send 2 cadet pilots, it might look like you are not willing to risk human lives."
"Right.
But if you go with a cadet, I am clearly not playing favorites."
Perkins rolled her eyes.
"Christ, Strebitch, you're right about this one."
"Of course," she mused with a hand rubbing her chin.
"I could send to Tula with a Ruhar cadet, which would make it an interspecies rescue operation."
Seeing the crestfallen look on Irene's face, she took pity on her pilot.
"Relax, Strebitch, you've sold me on the idea. Take to Tula and a cadet pilot to be safe.
Go bring that beetle here to us.
The beetle was a young machinist's mate named Ernt Dahl, who was barely older than the Ruhar cadets, as he had been aboard the Deal Me In as his first assignment out of school. The translator told Perkins that Dahl's rank of Arlon was something like junior ensign, or probationary ensign, so he was certainly not an experienced senior officer. He was overjoyed to be alive when the pod automatically revived him upon being brought into the pressurized environment of the Rue Tostella's docking bay. Part of Perkins had been hoping the Giraptha would naturally take on the burden of command after wakening, but Ernt was perfectly happy for Perkins to be in charge and apparently saw nothing odd about a human commanding a Ruhar ship. Despite Ernt's knowledge of technology far beyond Ruhar capabilities, he was not much help with the battered toaster. After an assessment that had his antennas drooping with despair, he agreed with Jin that the ship's one functioning reactor would shut down when its containment system failed, and there was nothing anyone could do about it with the equipment available. After initially being stunned and thrilled to see part of his ship had survived, Ernt was equally pessimistic about the condition of the Deal Me In. The reactors were basically scrap. Vented plasma had eaten into the backup power systems, and the engines that flew the ship through normal space were scrap. The only bright spot was the Star Carrier's jump drive system, for the coils and capacitors had come through the battle in fair condition.
The Star Carrier's jump drive is intact?
Perkins traced a finger along the schematic of the Star Carrier on the display in front of her.
Yes, remarkably so,
Ernt agreed, his antenna bobbing up and down vigorously.
Unfortunately, that is of no use to us. The jump drive control system was in the forward part of the ship, part of the navigation computer. We do not have any system to control the action of the jump coils.
Arlon Dahl, she used the Giraptha's rank to address him. Is there any way for this ship's drive system to control a Giraptha jump drive?
Ernt's antenna stood straight up in surprise and he looked away, perhaps embarrassed for the primitive human who asked such a foolishly ignorant question.
No.
Jin also was dismayed by being asked such a ridiculous question.
We don't have an interface with the...
Yes,
Tutula interjected with confidence.
The ship does have a capability to interface with the Giraptha jump drive.
Ernt and Jin just stared at Tutula, blinking slowly. If she had suddenly grown another head, they might have been less surprised.
How do you know that? Perkins asked, glancing between Ernt, Jin, and Tutula.
One of this ship's former officers told me about it. This is one advantage of being a member of an enemy species.
Tutula twisted her lips in a horrible version of a smile.
The Ruhar are always very happy to show me how superior they are. Your people,
he addressed the remark to Jin,
have of course been studying Giraptha jump drive technology every chance they get, particularly when your ships are attached to a star carrier. Each of your ships is equipped with a working computer model that emulates an interface with the Giraptha jump drive. Whenever a star carrier jumps, your ships simulate controlling the jump to test the accuracy of the model, and your fleet studies the results to refine the model. The officer who revealed this to me bragged that the emulator is now believed to be 96% accurate. He wanted me to know that the shortcomings of your jump drive technology are caused by hardware deficiencies, not by the lack of theoretical understanding or inability to program a drive controller. The Ruhar,
now she looked at Perkins,
know that Kristang jump drives are shamefully inaccurate. That is a failure of the warrior caste, not of my people. The warrior caste pays too little attention to anything not directly related to destructive power. My people,
she switched back to glaring at Jin,
would correct that error.
If we could interface our drive controller with the Giraptha system.
Jin's voice trailed off as she considered the possibilities, looking to Ernt for a sane voice to squelch an idea that must be mad. But the Giraptha only looked at the display pensively, not noticing her.
The Rue Tostella can attach to the hardpoint? Perkins asked, pointing to the one remaining docking platform that remained on the Star Carrier's shortened spine.
The Star Carrier jumps and we jump with it?
We can attach manually, yes.
Jin scratched the back of her head.
I think so. Unless the clamps there are damaged. Colonel, even if we can control a Giraptha jump drive,
We have no way to feed power into their capacitors. Physically, there is no connection between our reactor and the star carrier. I don't see any way to create a connection.
It is not possible,
Ernt muttered, his claws flitting across the controls, considering the question.
No, he concluded. Colonel Perkins, my specialty is power generation. I am not an expert on propulsion or jump drives or computers, but this is my area of expertise,
he declared with confidence beyond his few years of training.
There is no equipment aboard either ship for creating a stable power connection between this ship's reactor and the Star Carrier's capacitors. The input frequency of the capacitors is...
He blinked, looking around as if just then realizing he was in the presence of three alien species.
Well, that is not a specification I can discuss with you. I can assure you the capacitor charging system is delicate and requires a specific...
Yes, fine, I accept we can't recharge the Delmian's jump drive. What is the charge in those capacitors now? Perkins interrupted.
We don't know. I suppose we could determine that with our sensors,
Jin added, embarrassed.
It is...
She waited while the damaged sensor suite responded.
81% charge. That is an estimate, you understand. The Giraptha do not give us specifications for their systems,
she added with a guilty glance at Ernt.
82% is the correct number. I do not think I am giving away any secrets to tell you that,
Ernt confirmed with one eye on a display.
Our last jump was only medium distance, I think, so there was plenty of charge available when we jumped in here.
Understood. How many... No, wait. Not how many jumps. Perkins realized she had been about to ask the wrong question. How far could the Delmian jump with that charge?
I do not know, Ernt admitted without embarrassment. As I explained, I am a power technician. It is not possible, I think, for a single jump to use up that entire charge. The greatest power drain I remember from a single jump used up 34%, and that was with the ship burdened by carrying an entire heavy battle group of our own fleet. A series of jumps to use up the capacitors.
He rubbed his antenna together as he thought, in a gesture Perkins found fascinating and distracting.
Again, I do not know. It is a complicated question with many variables. Colonel, the charge in the capacitors is certainly not sufficient for us to travel 16 light-years, Jin guessed. If you are hoping to get back on our original flight path, in case the fleet is searching for us. What I want to know is where could we go?
The young Ruhar cadet was unhappy about being asked questions she could not find the answer to in a shipboard database.
That also is a guess.
Yes, yes. Show me a radius of 10 light-years to be conservative. Jin adjusted the display to show a sphere around their present position. To Perkins, it disappointingly still looked like a whole lot of nothing inside that sphere. That's it? Are there any habitable planets, data relays, refueling stations in there?
No,
Jin shook her head.
Except for what we suspect is a Theranin sensor station here. This was Theranin territory until recently. If there is a sensor station, it would be automated and of no use to us.
Of course, Perkins reprimanded herself for allowing her frustrations to show.
Wait, what is this?
She pointed to a glowing gold circle.
That is an Elder wormhole, but it leads to space controlled by the Kristang. The Ruhar cadet warned.
Space that was controlled by the Kristang,
Tutula corrected.
Reports indicate they were pulling back from that area, even before their latest civil war,
she noted with disgust that her people would regularly kill each other over trivial matters.
They had few assets in that region, and the Theranin have abandoned that entire part of the sector after their recent defeats by the Giraptha,
she added the last with a nod to Ernt, who lifted his head with pride.
I'll take your word about that, Perkins muttered.
Can we go through that wormhole? If we can, what is on the other side, which we could reach? Show me a 10 light-year radius around the other end of that wormhole.
It is possible for us to go through the wormhole,
Jin agreed unhappily. It took her a few minutes to pull up a star chart showing the other side of that wormhole, as the ship's navigation system had to retrieve seldom-used data about enemy territory.
Here, she announced when the display filled in. Two star systems with habitable planets.
She pointed at two dots on opposite directions from the wormhole.
The closest one is Kormat. The report says it has an estimated population of 300, but that data is 20 years old. Kormat was a logistics base that fell out of use. The fleet thinks the Kristang pulled it out of service.
She looked closer at the data.
Kormat may be on the margin of being considered habitable. It is a very cold world.
She shuddered at seeing some of the climate estimates.
The Kristang live there in domes under the ice, and the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is low.
Too risky. Too many ifs. Too many lizards, Perkins concluded without thinking she had just said lizards in front of Tutula.
You said there is a second habitable planet?
Yes, in the other star system. Jin peered closely at the data and gasped.
Colonel, you know this place. You have been there.
I have?
What? Your people designated this planet as Camp Alpha.
Holy shit. Emily Perkins did not have fond memories of that godforsaken planet.
The goddamned lizards are still there?
Jin searched through the data.
No. Fleet intelligence does not think the Kristang have maintained a presence there after your people shipped out. That planet was the property of the White Wind Clan, which suffered a severe loss of fortune, then recently was absorbed during their civil war.
How sure is Fleet Command about Camp Alpha being abandoned? As a career intel officer, Perkins would dearly love to see the raw intel take on that subject. How many times in her career had she published an assessment based on what she thought was solid gold intel, only to be proved wrong by the messy facts of reality?
The report... It...
Jin scrolled down through the data, then held up her hands.
It doesn't list a confidence factor.
We are certainly not going to the first planet you listed, Kormat, or whatever it's called.
Camp Alpha, god damn. Never thought I'd ever be setting foot on that.
She paused. She was describing a planet she might be asking the entire crew to land on and live for an undetermined length of time.
That world. Oh, hell.
She forced a laugh to lighten the mood.
It has oxygen, and the temperature isn't bad. No dangerous native life. From what I remember, even when the Kristang were running the place, their footprint on the surface didn't cover much territory.
Her mind raced to remember how much land area the X-Force base on Camp Alpha had covered. At its maximum, the force that left Earth had consisted of about 120,000 people, with the U.S. and China contributing 35,000 combat troops each, and the other three nations providing 15,000 each. Support and headquarters units and observers from other nations had rounded out another 5,000. One time only, she had been aloft in a Buzzard aircraft on a familiarization ride above Camp Alpha and gotten a bird's-eye view of the sprawling but temporary base and the much smaller and walled-off Kristang facility nearby. From 80,000 feet up, the base had looked unimpressive, and she recalled another officer telling her the entire base plus wargame training area occupied less space than the state of Connecticut. Since the planet was mostly land with only 20% of the surface covered by oceans, that left a lot of room to conceal a single ship full of cadets.
I'll consider Camp Alpha our best option until I hear otherwise. How long until we can jump?
Colonel?
I have no idea. I've never seen this emulator model.
She looked to Velt Tutula for help.
I did not know such technology existed until today.
The way she tilted her head, the cadet did not appear to fully buy into the idea of her people having ability to control a Giraptha jump drive.
I have never seen it either, Tutula admitted. Colonel, can you access it?
Emily Perkins had absolutely no idea what she could and could not do with her full set of command codes. She had never tested the limits.
There is not an icon for magical Giraptha jump drive emulator.
She regretted her sarcastic tone. When she was asking others to do the impossible, she should not be bitching about the pressure on her. The real problem was she felt she could not ask for help with simple tasks because that would display her profound ignorance. But she had no choice.
Something like that would probably be highly classified. Anyone got any suggestions?
I do not think the existence of the emulator is a deep secret,
Tutula noted.
The officer who told me said the Giraptha know about it.
She chuckled. A dry wheezing sound that caused a shiver of fear to shoot up Perkins's spine.
He said the Giraptha were probably wagering over how close the emulator is to their own system. Colonel, could it be as simple as searching for Giraptha jump drive emulator in your command codes?
It's worth a shot, Perkins observed as she typed the phrase into the handy search box, and presto, there it was.
Huh.
She looked up at Tutula.
Good guess.
I'm allowing engineering and the pilots access to the emulator. What I would like to ask the Giraptha fleet right now is what are the odds this will work? No one had an answer for her, but Ernt was twitching his legs in an agitated fashion, and the tips of his antenna were quivering.
What is wrong, Arlandahl? Perkins asked with concern. You think this emulator will not work? Or would it make you uncomfortable for us to attempt to control one of your jump drives?
No, Colonel. It is not surprising that a client species would seek to understand our technology, and I will assist with the necessary connections, for I wish to live.
He twisted his mouth parts in a smile that somehow was less creepy than when a Kristang made the same gesture.
It is just, he sighed.
What?
Wagering whether a Ruhar system could control one of our drives is incredibly tempting action, and I cannot register a bet out here in the wilderness.
The alien crewman looked so anguished at being unable to participate in the favorite activity of his species, Perkins almost felt sorry for him.
Arlandahl, we have a broken ship staffed by inexperienced cadets attached to the even more broke-ass end of a star carrier. To get to a habitable planet, we need to jump several times without the ship exploding, transit a wormhole into enemy territory, and probably travel a long distance through space to land on a planet that may or may not have a Kristang presence. So I will bet you that we will never set foot on Camp Alpha.
Ernt's antenna moved in unison excitedly.
What odds are you giving?
Perkins had no idea, so she made up a number that sounded good.
5-1.
5-1? No points?
No points, Perkins offered, guessing that points were a bad thing.
That is...
Ernt began with enthusiasm before his expression became downcast.
That all sounds good, but I suspect you have nothing to wager with, and also we have no way to properly register the wager.
Arlandahl, Perkins grinned. We will be dropping off flight recorder buoys before we jump. We can include details of the wager in the buoy databank. And think about this. The only way we can reach Camp Alpha is by getting this emulator software to work properly. I believe the Ruhar fleet would be more than happy to cover my side of the wager to learn their software is functional.
Oh, Ernt brightened, his mouth parts moving rapidly. In that case, I want 7-1.
Deal.
Perkins held out a hand, and Ernt held out a leathery claw, and they shook. It took another 10 minutes of negotiating back and forth to finalize the wager, with Perkins arguing only because she felt Ernt expected her to.
Excellent, excellent, the very happy Giraptha declared. Now, show me this emulator system. I am not a jump drive specialist or navigator, but I do know about the power input requirements. It may be necessary for me to tweak the emulator settings so the drive does not explode.